I think it's fair to say this is not your typical election.
Have you always told the truth?
I've always tried to.
Hillary Clinton is a bigot.
These are racist ideas, race-baiting ideas, anti-Muslim, anti-immigrant, anti-women.
Hillary Clinton and her campaign of 2008 started the birther controversy. I finished it.
When you're running for president, I think you have an obligation to be healthy.
Every time I think about Trump, I get allergic.
I have a winning temperament. I know how to win. She does not have
Secretary
how to win.
Clinton.
Wait.
Secretary Clinton.
Woo, okay.
USA! USA! USA!
From the New York Times, this is The Run-Up. I'm Michael Barbaro. When Donald Trump describes black communities as dystopian war zones, does it make it less cringeworthy to think about him as a kind of Archie Bunker character?
Boy, the way Glenn Miller played.
Songs that made the hit parade.
Guys like us, we had it made. Those were the days.
Or when you try to understand Hillary Clinton's marriage, is it comforting to think about the quiet dignity and defiance of Alicia Florrick on The Good Wife?
Seriously, Peter? I stand beside you at every damn event. You go off banging prostitutes two at a time.
You don't want to go there.
And I stand beside you like a grinning fool.
You let it go. For God's sakes, let it go.
Truth is, we know Alicia and Archie better than we know Hillary and Donald. We can find, in these more fully formed characters that resemble the candidates, an explanation of what might motivate them, a possible glimpse into the interior lives that they withhold from us. The chief TV critic at the Times, James Poniewozik, is here to talk about some of those characters and about just how much Trump and Clinton themselves have influenced characters in television and film. Is Donald Trump Tony Soprano with nicer clothes?
He is Tony Soprano with the nicest clothes. The best, the finest, believe me. Donald Trump is, like Tony Soprano, he's an entertaining anti-hero. He's, you know, somebody who... part of his shtick, part of his pitch is, you know, I might not be the nicest guy in the world, but I get things done and you don't want to mess with me and I'm good at doing those things. I think also that I'm struck by some personality characteristics that you saw in Tony that look really familiar when you look at somebody like Donald Trump. Somebody who, you know, is surrounded by validators, by yes men. By, you know, people who are around to tell him that he's making the right decision.
And to bring him his Bialys.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, their dietary habits are probably not dissimilar.
So true.
Yeah. Tony takes things personally. He's very, you know, peevish. He can be very peevish, values loyalty, and gets very aggrieved and defensive, particularly about things that are about himself. Here's what I mean by that. One thing that we saw in the debate between Trump and Hillary was that the Clinton camp seemed to have figured out that you could particularly bait Donald Trump into reaction most strongly, not by attacking his policies or, you know, say, but by saying things that are about him, right? You are, you know, a sexist or whatever, that he will not let an attack on himself go unchallenged.
This is a man who has called women pigs, slobs, and dogs.
Do you want to know the truth? I was going to say something extremely rough to Hillary, to her family, and I said to myself, I can't do it. I just can't do it. It's inappropriate. It's not nice.
And in a weird way, it reminds me of, you know, a lot of the ways that The Sopranos characterized Tony. If you remember when he killed Ralphie Cifaretto, right, there was this long simmering feud between him and this character played by Joe Pantoliano, this mob associate and rival. And you think it's going to come to a head and it's going to be over something in the business or somebody's going to make a move on the other. And instead, he kills him in this fit of pique in a personal fight that involves Tony's racehorse. And, you know, like that's the thing, you know, with Tony, just the personal petty grievance rules over everything, and you know he's unable to control that.
What's going on? Come on.
Oh,
I found him like this.
Guy was a piece of shit. Whoever did this should have happened a long time ago.
You know, I think one thing that has risen in television in the past decade or two that's kind of informed our understanding and reception of a figure like Donald Trump is this notion of the anti-hero, the sort of fascinating rogue type person who may be rough, may be abrasive, but is also fascinating to watch and compelling to follow, you know, even in his villainy. So, you know, I think that there are a lot of models for that. And it's, you know, it's difficult when you talk about Donald Trump and his models because Donald Trump is a television character in himself. He created a version of himself with Mark Burnett for The Apprentice. But watching the first presidential debate, I think I was particularly struck just in his bearing, in his delivery, that sort of James Gandolfini-esque, you know, hunched aggression that you see in a figure like Tony Soprano.
You're talking about the anti-hero, and that's a really powerful concept in pop culture. And I wonder who else you think occupies that place in our televised imagination, you know, kind of Donald Trump, the anti-hero, and how do they help us understand him?
For one thing, it is also a type that you see a lot in reality television, where the notion is that you don't necessarily root for, you know, who you think is the best person or the most sympathetic character, but often it will be the most colorful or sly or conniving villain. In a way, the way that characters on reality shows achieve and sort of sell themselves to the audience and their competitors is kind of like the way Donald Trump has changed the terms of appealing to voters as a candidate, right? Like, you know, traditionally as a politician, you're trying to convince people that you're the best person. You have values. You are trustworthy. You know, you check off these moral boxes. Whereas with Trump, you know, it's, you know, how he talks about, you know, I was always greedy, 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 and now I'll be greedy for you. I have these aspects of me that people may have seen as roguish or villainous, but I'm going to be your villain. I'm going to be working for you. And, you know, it reminds me, Trump making his case in the election reminds me of somebody like Richard Hatch on the first season of Survivor. You know, he was sort of the first quintessential broadcast network TV reality villain. And he was part of what made the first season of Survivor so successful. And, you know, the tradition in television used to be you would root against the bad guy and you would root for the good guys, the people who were moral. But Richard Hatch created this dynamic where in lying and cheating and stabbing people in the back, he was so entertaining and compelling that people would follow him and you would want him to stay on because the show would be more entertaining with than without him. Well, in Survivor, Survivor sort of goes through a primary, right? Where, you know, like Donald Trump,
so
you're up against 16 or 18 people and they go down one by one by one. And then it's you and somebody else. And you've got the closing argument to make to the jury.
Rich, you are a very openly arrogant, pompous human being. But I admire your frankness with it. On the other hand, your inability to admit your failures without going into a whiny speech makes you a bit of a loser in life.
Richard Hatch, in his famous argument that I think bears some parallels to what you hear from Donald Trump, didn't make the case, you know, give me the $1 million because I'm a good guy, because you like me so much. It was, I have lied and cheated and backstabbed and, you know, been the snake in the grass all the way through this. And I have backstabbed many of you on the jury. And that proves how good I am. You know, that proves how, you know, I alone can fix it. Right?
God, that really does sound familiar.
And the argument becomes, because of the craft I have shown in doing this, you got to admire it.
Right.
And sure enough, Richard Hatch won that first $1 million. I think if Richard Hatch hadn't won, you know, the first Survivor, that might have sort of changed the ethos of reality TV going forward and would have made, you know, Survivor and maybe the reality genre different. But that created a model for this kind of argument.
A model for you're fired?
a model for, you're fired. Yes. I mean,
The Apprentice.
The Apprentice was sort of an unusual thing, too, in reality television because, you know, in reality TV, usually you have the hosts or the judges or whatever, and then you have the stars, the contestants. On The Apprentice, Donald Trump really was the host and the judge and the star. I mean, there were, you know, some notable contenders, Omarosa in the early seasons. Later, it was Celebrity Apprentice. But the show was really built around him as a personality, the way that, say, you know, The Bachelor is not built around Chris Harrison. And it was very useful for Donald Trump, I think, because it did, on a big scale, something that Donald Trump had been doing since at least the 1980s, you know, which is performing the persona, embodying the symbols of business success.
I wonder how much you as a TV critic blame television writers for allowing us as a culture to fall in love with some of these rogue figures. Take the original Archie Bunker and saying the unsayable, articulating some truly offensive sentiments, and yet America was eating out of his palm. How do we get from there to here, and who's responsible?
You know, it's tough because it is certainly disturbing when you see, you know, the power of using basically the tools of fiction to, you know, put yourself over on a nation as a candidate. On the other hand, I can't say I entirely blame TV writers for this, because one reason, the big knock on Archie Bunker and All in the Family, was that he's this bigot who nonetheless is entertaining and amusing and therefore lovable, and you know, people might take it the wrong way. And it's true, that is a danger. That is also the reason that All in the Family was one of the greatest sitcoms of all time, because it had that complexity.
Daddy, you had Sammy Davis Jr. in your cab!
As sure as you're sitting there.
What, you sure it was Sammy Davis Jr.?
No, meathead, it was some Zulu jockey. I know the man. Besides, you give me a $5 tip for a buck and a quarter haul anyway. And as fine a gentleman as ever you want to meet. Sat there in the back of the cab talking to me about the weather, all kinds of things, just like a regular person. In fact, if it wasn't for the rear view mirror there, I'd have thought he was a white guy.
What do you gotta say things like that for?
What do you mean, what have I gotta say things like that for? What did I say anyhow?
In great art and even great simple entertainment, there has to be the room for your audience to interpret. There has to be room for people to come to the quote-unquote wrong interpretation. There has to be room for people to decide that, you know, Walter White, you know, the meth dealer on Breaking Bad, is the hero of Breaking Bad, rather than sort of a cautionary tale of what happens when, you know, a regular person makes bad choice after bad choice and becomes a villain. That's always a danger. But, you know, I think ultimately the responsibility is with the audience and with, you know, politicians who use those tools deceptively, maybe with, you know, a media that doesn't puncture those, you know, artificial images as well.
So before we move on to Hillary Clinton, I want to talk about why it is we're even tackling this subject of pop culture and the characters that it has given us and this presidential campaign. And I have a theory, which is that when it comes to a Donald Trump or a Hillary Clinton, there's this kind of problem of us having a pretty limited exposure to their interior lives. Like, we sort of think we know them, they're larger than life, but we actually don't know very much about the way they think and the way they really live. So we look to pop culture, whether consciously or subconsciously, because those characters, we do know their interior lives so, so well. I wonder if that's the right way to think about the role of pop culture and the election, that has given us these guideposts in the election.
Sure. I mean, I'm biased as a critic, but I think that fiction is a really useful lens to look at real life like this, because as you say, there are only so many people that any of us in our lives know well, family, close friends, you know, children. Beyond that, you know, most of the people that you interact with and people that see on the news are sort of ciphers to you, right? When you come to understand fictional characters, you understand them in a deeper way and in a sort of non-literal way that just carries greater meaning than, you know, a biography or a list of policy positions. So I think that being able to liken somebody to something that you've seen in a story is a way of getting, yeah, it's a way of getting an understanding in a kind of intimate level that's not available to you otherwise.
So let's turn to Hillary Clinton. Which characters in television, past or present, inform your understanding and our understanding of her?
Okay, so Hillary Clinton, let me start this off by saying I think there's sort of some interesting similarities and differences with Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton in this campaign, because on the one hand, they're both, and this is unusual for a presidential election, they are both characters in pop culture, characters in mass media, whose stories we've literally been hearing for decades, and we're very familiar with them. You know, usually in an election, there's some narrative of somebody, you know, some new character who you haven't encountered before. Barack Obama in 2008, you know, with George W. Bush in 2000. Here, it's two long-running American television serials having a crossover episode, right? But the difference is, you know, as we've been talking about, Donald Trump is very consciously, professionally self-mythologizing. Hillary Clinton is a pop culture figure, but a pop culture figure who sort of has been mythologized from the outside more than from within. And that's because, you know, as you well know, and political journalists have talked about, you know, her nature is to be reserved, to be guarded, withhold of herself out of caution. So I think, you know, the picture that we've gotten of Hillary Clinton in popular culture has come more from characters that are sort of inspired by her, that are, you know, inspired by what her life has played out about, you know, dynamics of gender with, you know, women in public life and that sort of thing. So, you know, you see Hillary Clinton reflected in, say, somebody like, I think, particularly The Good Wife's Alicia Florrick. The Good Wife being the recently concluded CBS drama that starts with Alicia Florrick standing by her husband in the middle of a sex scandal.
Peter can't win without you. You know that. Peter only wins with your good housekeeping seal of approval. Voters need to see you together up on that stage holding hands.
Goodbye, Mr. Gold.
She is a very guarded person. I think one thing that's sort of fascinating about The Good Wife is that, you know, usually protagonists, they need to be charismatic. They need to be extroverts. Alicia Florrick actually is, by her nature, even though she is the star character of the show, very much an introvert. She's somebody who, over the course of the series, she becomes a successful lawyer. She runs for office. She becomes politically active. But she has to really work at it.
She pulls a Hillary Clinton.
She pulls a Hillary Clinton, and in the way that Hillary Clinton does. You know, she is not a natural politician. She has an interest in public service, but is not a natural public figure. And that's just sort of interesting because that's not something that has usually lent itself well to television. And as we've seen sometimes with Hillary Clinton, it's not our usual template for measuring public candidates, right? Like, we have all these standards of charisma that are about, you know, being very performative and wanting to put yourself out there and so on. You've seen a bit of a flip side of that in House of Cards, for instance, where you have Claire Underwood, who is, you know, sort of the conspiracy blogs, you know, picture of Hillary Clinton.
And she's the alt-right Hillary Clinton.
Basically. The InfoWars Hillary Clinton. The notion of, you know, and House of Cards obviously is conspiratorial about everybody. But, you know, this notion that it is built around this power marriage of Claire and Frank Underwood, who connive their way through the power structure and into the White House. And, you know, it plays off a lot of these stereotypes about deceptive politicians and female politicians, in her case in particular. But I think it also plays into, you know, at least in the American version, one pop cultural fascination with the Clintons, which has been, you know, people still talk about how, you know, I wonder what really goes on in that marriage. What's the deal between them? How do they feel about each other?
They secretly take drags off the same cigarette.
Exactly. So, you know, it's an attempt at giving an answer to that sort of thing from a much darker perspective.
Hi.
Hello. More wine?
Mm.
How was your date?
Good.
Adam well?
He is. We just had dinner. I emailed Remy on the way home. I told him I'm not taking the money.
Thank you. I appreciate that this was not easy.
Well, we don't like easy, do we?
And then, you know, one other reflection of the Hillary type figure that's really struck me in TV in recent years is Leslie Knope, played by Amy Poehler in the NBC sitcom Parks and Recreation, who is a civil servant, a bureaucrat in Indiana Parks and Recreation Department, again, also becomes more politically active and runs for office. Now, Leslie Knope is sort of, if you are a liberal Democrat Hillary Clinton fan, your sort of fantasy version of how you wish that she could be or be characterized, right? Because in the same way that Hillary Clinton has often been knocked for this thing that female politicians often get tagged with, you know, which is, you know, over-preparing, being a grind, being, you know, overly assiduous and over-eager. Leslie Knope is this comically in a positive way, zealous public servant who, you know, if she gets a minor task to carry out for the Parks and Rec Department, will come out with six color-coded binders with coordinated post-its and so on. And it's kind of a way of flipping that, you know, Tracy Flick stereotype from the movie Election about the, you know, overly ambitious, a student, you know, female politician, and making it lovable and relatable and making it into a positive.
What I hear when I'm being yelled at is people caring loudly at me.
Did you watch the Democratic National Convention? Because what struck me about Hillary Clinton's speech there, and maybe I'm projecting a little bit, is that she almost tried to Leslie Knopenize herself into someone whose motivations were pure and earnest, and she'd hoped that the world would begin to see her like a Leslie character rather than a Tracy character.
You know, I think so. Because I think, you know, the Tracy Flick version of this type is somebody who is out for things for themselves.
Dear Lord Jesus, I do not often speak with you and ask for things, but now I really must insist that you help me win the election tomorrow, because I deserve it and Paul Metzler doesn't, as you well know.
Leslie Knope's, you know, flaw, if you want to call it that, is caring too much about everything. And so, you know, there was definitely this very constructed narrative at the Democratic National Convention of her various validators, Michelle Obama, Tim Kaine, and so on, talking about her early life, her work with children, you know, her doing, you know, this or that thing, you know, not because it necessarily advantaged her, but because she wanted to help.
So, Jim, in Parks and Recreation, there's a wonderful subplot in which Leslie Knope is running for city council against Bobby Newport, the kind of flashy, pretty boy. Let's listen to this.
Why'd you guys post that video of me, man? I mean, that didn't make me feel good. It was mean. You guys are mean.
Well, we used your own ad, so I don't think it was mean.
All right, just stop running, okay? Just stop.
Stop running the ad?
No, stop running the campaign.
What?
Just quit. It would be so cool of you if you just quit.
I'm running for office because I want to improve the lives of the people that I love in the city that's the greatest city in the world.
Hey, I've got an idea. How about you quit running, then I win, but then I let you do all the work.
I'm not going anywhere, and we are going to debate soon, and I need to warn you, I know my stuff.
God, that seems awfully familiar.
Yeah, I mean, in life and in fiction, right? And again, that's the dynamic from the movie Election, you know, where you have Tracy Flick, the A student, running against the charismatic popular jock who doesn't really, you know, try to win the election and yet succeeds anyway.
I want to go back to The Sopranos because there's a scene in which the writers of that show mention Hillary Clinton by name and at length. It's a scene in which Carmela Soprano, the wife of Tony Soprano, is having lunch at an Italian restaurant with the wives of fellow mobsters, and they all begin to talk about their really complicated feelings about Hillary Clinton.
It's not just us.
The president of the United States, for crying out loud. I mean, look what his wife had to put up with the blowjobs and the stained dress.
Hillary Clinton? I can't stand that woman.
I don't know. Maybe we could all take a page from her book.
What, to be humiliated in public and then walk around smiling all the time? That is so false. I would dig a hole, I would climb into it, and I would not come out.
All I know is she stuck by him and put up with the bullshit. And in the end, what did she do? She set up her own little thing.
She did. She took all that negative shit he gave her and spun it into gold. You gotta give her credit.
Well, that's true, isn't it? She's a role model for all of us.
I mean, the silence after that scene is that, as that idea from Carmela kind of settles in. But what is that whole scene really about when we think about Hillary Clinton?
There's an irony we know, you know, watching it right off the bat, that, you know, it's saying, oh, I can't believe she put up with that. You know, their lives are built around putting up with that. Pretty much all of their husbands cheat on them in that way or worse. You know, and you know, what is it to be, you know, a mob wife? You know, like in The Sopranos, you have all this stuff and you don't have anything. None of it's actually yours. It's on loan from your husband. It's conditional.
And it can be taken away.
It can be taken away. And, unless you make some effort to, you know, squirrel away a thing here or there that's yours, if your, you know, husband leaves you or gets whacked or goes to prison or something like that. So, you know, it's I think, you know, one thing that you're seeing dawn on them is that it's not unlike being first lady, where you have great visibility and power, but it's conditional. It's on another person. It's from, you know, somebody else. And, you know, maybe the only way to get that thing for yourself is to accept, you know, yeah, okay, I'm in this compromised position. You know, I've made some choices. My life has not been perfect, but it is what it is. And, you know, I'm going to use that to try and get my own thing and do well with that.
So as a TV critic watching this campaign that has so thoroughly blurred the lines between entertainment and politics, I wonder how it is that you would review this 2-year-long campaign show.
I think the writers have really taken it over the top. It's like, you know, watching, you know, Scandal in its 8th season or something, where you just feel that they have exhausted every possible trick and they're emptying their notebooks at you. Dial it back a bit, I say, election 2016. Trust your audience a little more. Give us some credit.
Okay, so would you commit to another season?
I think I'd like to see it recast. Yeah, I think the pilot could go back for a rewrite and some recasting.
Jim, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Hi, this is Eric Kim with New York Times Cooking. As a recipe developer, I spend a lot of my time trying to come up with dishes that are quick, easy, but also very special. For me, that means dishes like gochugaru salmon. It's a crispy salmon fillet with a salty, sweet glaze that bubbles up and candies. I love cooking this because it only takes 20 minutes. I developed this recipe when I was down in Georgia with my family. It stars a Korean red pepper powder called gochugaru. I love the way it blooms in the maple syrup and the rice vinegar. If you don't have gochugaru, you should totally get some. It's super versatile. It's not just that it brings heat, but fruity sweetness as well. You can get this recipe and so many more ideas on New York Times Cooking. Visit nytcooking.com to get inspired.
So Jim wants to recast the campaign, but on television right now, the White House is being recast. The odds are actually pretty good that the presidents you see on screen today, or the vice presidents, are women. It turns out the fictional world of television is more progressive than the reality of American politics. Susan Dominus, over at The Times Magazine, is studying how gender plays out in this election. She spotted something during the recent National Security Forum, hosted by Matt Lauer, that nobody else seemed to notice, despite all the controversy it touched off.
Well, most people think that Matt Lauer sat down with Donald Trump and it was, you know, two bros who go way back from the days when Lauer was interviewing Trump in his apprentice days on the Today Show. They were just hanging out and there was like a nice rapport there. There was some like mutual respect. I actually wondered if it was something a little bit different, which was that in this instance, you know, Matt Lauer oddly represents sort of the traditional feminine role vis-a-vis Hillary Clinton in the sense that he was the the morning talk show host. He's kind of Katie Couric Manquet, and he's the pretty face. And here is Hillary Clinton, who's the elder statesperson. She is the military expert. She is the former Secretary of State. And I actually felt that in that instance, Lauer possibly was doing that thing that, you know, women sort of tend to do, which is this idea that you have to try twice as hard. I felt like Lauer was trying too hard.
Or be twice as hard.
Try twice as hard, act twice as tough.
Right, but you you're going to cheat.
Look, this is an important issue. I know we're on TV. We don't have a lot of time.
I want to get to a lot of questions.
I will talk quickly. So
I'm going to get to that subject, Secretary Clinton.
In the Afghanistan-Pakistan theater.
I am fast running out of time. As briefly as you can.
I want to just say one additional thing.
I've got 30 seconds left.
Whereas here's like Trump, also a celebrity. You know, he's this guy with the crazy hair. He comes from some glitzy environment. And he's sort of relaxed. He didn't, you know, when Lauer is interviewing Trump, when Trump is, you know, the star of The Apprentice and Lauer is the, you know, the anchor, then Lauer gets to be the sort of, you know, male authority figure. And Trump was sort of the lightweight. So that's a dynamic to which he's actually quite accustomed. And I just felt like that sort of, he let his guard down with Trump, whereas he was sort of trying twice as hard, as you say, with Hillary.
And just to be clear, in that equation, it is Donald Trump who's also kind of a feminized figure.
I actually do see that in some ways. I do see, for all of his bluster, when you think about it, like when was the last time that people were this obsessed with a candidate's hair? It was Hillary in 2008, you know, not even this election cycle. It's there's something about him that reads as... If we are going to sort of like extend sort of gender stereotypes all the way to their kind of worst place, it's, you know, celebrity, lightweight, that reads as sort of, you know, in some ways feminine and inconsequential or not perceived as a real threat.
Now that you mention it, we do spend more time thinking about and talking about Donald Trump's appearance than I think we do Hillary Clinton's in this campaign. And is that a mark of progress or the peculiarity of him?
It's a little bit hard to say. I mean, you know, there are things that you can say as a woman to a man. I mean, this Hillary basically called Donald Trump crazy in the debate. And I, you know, think she used it very effectively. And it's language that has been traditionally used to sort of disempower women. But I think that she could do that. And if Trump had tried to do that, he now knows that he's clearly been trained. You know, he couldn't call her neurotic or crazy in the middle of a debate, which is language he's obviously used in the past. But for whatever his failings were in the debate, he knew not to do that. He knew not to, you know, call Hillary ugly. You know, he's been trained to some degree. So just as Hillary could kind of get away with calling Trump crazy, no one, you know, no commentator, no right-wing talk show host wants to comment on Hillary's looks, because we've been through that already in 2008 and it did not reflect well on anybody and people really took note.
Sue, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
The Run-Up is a production of The New York Times. Our executive producer is Lisa Tobin. Vanessa Romo is our head writer. Samantha Hennig is our showrunner. Our director is Sam Dolnick. Carolyn Ryan is our guest star. Pedro Rosado is our cameraman. Every good drama has a theme song. Ours is by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. That's it for The Run-Up. I'm Michael Barbaro. I'll see you back here on Tuesday.